at Global Spiritual Life at NYU, and this is Multifaithful, the podcast about religious diversity, multifaith dialogue, and effing the ineffable. On this week's episode, I am joined by Dr. Jerusha Lamptey, an assistant professor of Islam and ministry at Union Theological Seminary. We discuss the state of Islamic studies within the Western universities, what it's like being a Muslim academic, and her work on comparative feminist theology at the end, which is a first for this podcast and was an amazing conversation. So thank you for listening to Multifaithful, and out of this brief conversation. I am joined today by Dr. Jerusha Lamptey, the director of the Islam Social Justice and Interreligious Engagement Program at Union Seminary. Jerusha, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
And I'm also joined by a soon-to-be member of the team at NYU. Matt, can you introduce yourself?
Yeah, my name is Matt Gasecki. I'm originally from Ohio, the mild Midwest, and I study interreligious engagement, psychology and religion, particularly Christianity and Buddhism in dialogue here at Union.
Great, and Matt will be joining us as the student worker next year, so we're looking forward to having him hopefully back on this podcast a few more times next year.
I hope so.
So, Dr. Lamptey, you are working at a Christian seminary and teaching about Islam and interreligious engagement. So I'm very curious how that came to be and how you ended up here teaching about these topics.
Okay, so I think that there's probably like the long-winded somewhat theoretical and boring mm-hmm. answer to that question. I mean, I came to work here because Union decided that they were going to expand their interreligious capacity explicitly, mm-hmm. and that was done under a grant through Luce originally. So that's kind of the boring mm-hmm. piece. But why that came into being and why I would want to be here, maybe that's what we're getting at. So I think why that came to be is that Union has historically always been a place where there was an openness to other perspectives, and even maybe that started as being non-denominational. Union wasn't, but then became. And so there was at least an ecumenical interest. Mm-hmm. And then there had always been some people in-house who were teaching on other traditions or other voices present, such as Heschel and other people mm-hmm. like this. I do think in the last maybe 5-6 years ago, there was a greater interest in Islam and bringing on some capacity in Islam, and there was no capacity here. Mm-hmm. So that's how the position was created. I think my interest in coming here is that I come from an Islamic studies background, but much of my work and research is on religious diversity and mm-hmm. basically questions of how we grapple with and make sense of the fact that different people within different traditions and different religious identities lay claim to the same space in mm-hmm. rather exclusive and intriguing ways. And I've been interested in trying to unpack those questions. The other piece of it, the why I wanted to come to Union, is that I also do feminist theological work, and Union is very well known to be a place where those kind of discourses are birthed. So whether it's Black liberation theology, womanist thinking and ethics and theology, they started here. And so for me, there was an attractiveness to being in a place that had a critical but loving and boundary-pushing discourse at its soul. Mm-hmm.
So, Matt, I'm curious if this has been your experience as well, someone who's been studying religious studies for a while, but I know that when I was a student, I took a lot of religion classes and classes mm-hmm. about Islam, and they were actually almost never taught by someone who was Muslim. They were often mm-hmm. taught by kind of someone else who had studied Islam. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious is that sort of a dynamic that is changing a little bit, or like there are going to be more Muslim people also teaching Islam in settings like this? Because I think the experience that Union had a couple years ago of realizing we don't have the capacity to teach this is not atypical for American universities. Like, I don't think there are as amazingly diverse and interesting set of courses on Islam as there are for Judaism and Christianity, especially. Mm-hmm. I'm curious what you two think about that.
Yeah, that would be an accurate summary of my experience of religions, particularly beyond Christianity. In my college experience, there seemed to be in like a course on like introduction to religion or a world religion survey or some sort of, you know, anything on a comparative religious track. It's distinguished by its attempt to suspend judgment, suspend affiliation with what it's studying. That might be because the professor who I was mentored by in religious studies in college was an anthropologist and ethnographist by trade, and had learned so thoroughly how to separate oneself from the subject of her study. And the subject of her study was particularly religions of Asia. So Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam, and then, you know, like Chinese traditional religions and other religions of India. And it is certainly it's notable to me that emphasis on philosophy and on doctrine sometimes takes more of a focus than emphasis on sort of on daily practice, daily living, in that way of teaching, I guess. But what perhaps was unique in my experience was that in spite of her training as an anthropologist and ethnographist, she identified as a Jubu, a Jewish Buddhist, and was an expert in Tibetan Buddhism in particular. And there were elements of faith in how she taught, and I didn't get that necessarily from other, you know, parts of a world religions curriculum. But Islam, to be honest, was probably the most lacking in my religious studies education, actually.
You know, it's an interesting question because I would say that statistically speaking, there are more Muslim-identified people going into the field of Islamic studies. And so there are more, and I've even seen some discourses recently within the AR, which is the American Academy of Religion, talking about, you know, is Islamic studies becoming too confessional, you know, and because... which is code for are there too many Muslims teaching in Islamic studies? And so I guess what I would want to say is that I think that it is true that there are more Muslims. I think historically it is also very true and easy to document in the birth of Islamic studies departments or Near East studies or Middle East studies departments that those not just an Orientalist slant, but a largely non-Muslim slant.
Right.
And even with Orientalism, it is what it is, but it also, some of it was very loving and in-depth scholarship. But kind of the historical trajectory and the development of that discipline has not been spearheaded by people who identify in some capacity with the tradition. That has been accurate. I do think that the statistics show that that is changing somewhat. I think what probably is important to raise up, though, is that it's an interesting, in light of the confessional comment I just made, it's an interesting dynamic going on there.
Yeah.
Because there's somehow some assumption that if you are Muslim-identified, you are somehow less capable of a critical distance or critical eye on your tradition. And that's not necessarily equally expanded to other people who identify in some capacity with what they teach. And so if it is, you know, and that could be in religious identification, but in other areas of identification, that there is some collapsing and assumption that if you explicitly identify as a Muslim and you teach Islamic studies, that you're going to teach it in a confessional and therefore problematic way.
Yeah.
And I don't think that is, I know that's not accurate,
right.
But it is an assumption of the bigger field, I think. And
that's
even in, back to Matt's point about, you know, distance, there's a lot of literature around teaching of religion, especially interreligious teaching now, that is really probing the distance paradigm.
Yeah.
And the idea, the assumption that, you know, if you identify with what you're teaching in religion, that somehow you're so susceptible to bringing your confessional or normative claims upon it, and you're not capable of anything. But the other flip side of that is the assumption that anthropology doesn't have normative claims. And as an anthropologist and ethnographist, I would say it certainly has normative claims, and that psychology doesn't have normative claims. And so I find it fascinating to, yes, this is a trajectory, and there are more Muslim voices present and more Muslim identified, but there are certain latent assumptions that are clearly in play.
Well, I want to come back to the separation between maybe the confessional and the purely academic, but I'm curious... I remember as a student, whenever I would take like biblical studies classes that were academic Bible, and as someone who comes from a Jewish day school system that is not teaching academic Bible, I remember when I started learning that stuff, like doing a lot of reading about how when academic Bible first became like a subject, how early Jewish thinkers started to deal with these realities. And I imagine that there was probably a parallel of like Jewish people who went into early Bible research, who there was like a certain distancing, or there was a certain awkwardness there. Is that mirroring some of what's going on with Islamic studies, or are we talking about different dynamics here?
Well, I think in some ways it's mirrored. I mean, not exactly. Nothing's ever mirrored exactly. But I do think that it changes. It can change the discussion. It can change some of the assumptions. It can also change just the way you approach this subject matter. I mean, it should come as no wonderful surprise that Islam, both publicly and within the academy, is off-presented as the other or different or foreign. And if you don't see that subject matter as being other or different or foreign and you begin to teach it, you will teach it differently. So there will be a different approach. And so that in and of itself. But I think there are some parallels in that, for instance, in Quranic studies, the type of scholarship done, I don't want to make a total unequivocal split between what Muslims are doing and non-Muslims are doing, because it's not a complete split. But surely the projects of interest, I mean, there are some historical, critical, early text, early manuscript stuff, work being done on the Quran, but many Muslim scholars of the Quran are more interested in discursive analysis, or more interested in, you know, interpretation theory, or things of that sort, or analyzing interpretations rather than, you know, so there are projects of talking about where the text came from and do we have fragments and manuscripts, but then there's also... And it's no longer, I have to be honest, with, you know, there's now the International Quranic Studies Association, kind of like SBL, Society of Biblical Literature, that they do more of that study. So it's not a straight line, but yeah, I mean, there's some talking past discourse, like different discourses. And I think, I guess what I would say as someone involved in many of those discourses is that there have been some tensions to kind of elevate one or the other, but it seems that they're just different and they're not necessarily in conflict, but they're different approaches to the same topic.
So, but I want to now come back to sort of this breakdown, you know, this like distancing in the academy sometimes, because as we were, right before we started recording, you were talking about... teaching a world religions class that is a bit more experiential and sort of world religions, and you seem to there were a lot, and it actually mirrored a lot of conversations that we have in the office, and that Matt, you're gonna, you know, I'm sure you can relate to this, of trying to, one of my primary roles at NYU is to teach people about religious diversity and how to approach religious diversity better, but I also like firmly don't believe that a 3-hour 101 to religions class is of much value to people. And so trying to figure out how to teach it in an experiential way, like all of these questions are ones that we wrestle with a lot at NYU. So I think I was sensing some similarity there before we started recording.
So I mean, the class that I was talking about is a class that is required here for MDivs, and it's called Religions in the City. So it's very much focused on experiencing religious diversity, but experiencing a contextual manifestation of religious diversity here in the city proper. You know, so... Union has never been totally Christian in terms of who is here, and it's certainly never been one version of Christianity. So it's multiple denominations, but now increasingly people who multiple identify or spiritually but not religious identify or are not, are atheist identify. So it's become even more, it's a Christian institution. It has, that's the history, that's the important piece of the identity. But increasingly the student population is diverse. And so that class is meant to expose people to maybe traditions that they have not been exposed to. But the interesting thing that is happening is, of course, now there are students in that class that come from the traditions that are being
taught.
And so it has, it necessarily has to change. And I mean, as a teacher, I'm always trying to keep up with that and feeling that that's a hard thing to keep up with. But what the class tries to do is grapple explicitly with the limitations of the world religions model and this idea that we're starting from a Christocentric version and then everything else is other, and that we'll put everything else in conversation with Christianity. And it does that by, you know, explicitly looking at some of the writings around the concept of religion. It does that by explicitly foregrounding internal religious diversity, which is that great thing that we know exists, but only know it exists in our own tradition, and pretend like everybody else in other traditions just, it's like, what does a Jew do, and what does a Buddhist do? And then we use that very superficial and naive, but utile construct to kind of navigate. And so we foreground those things, but we also do a number of different approaches to learning in that class. And one is obviously textual exposure. Instead of, we've opted not to expose that, have students read primary materials that are synthesized and here's Buddhism and, you know, 30 pages, but rather have them have glimpses of all different literature from the tradition. It's a little chaotic, but it's intentionally so. It's like learning a language. You're thrown in and you hear the language and eventually your mind starts to sort out. The other thing that we do is we visit sites, and we visit sites during times when they're engaging in worship. So sometimes participating in that, sometimes not. There's boundary negotiation that goes on, because another element of this course is self-reflection. I think that's a big piece that being at a seminary allows us to do, because rather than just learning the content about and gaining religious literacy and in terms of facts and details about other, we're also thinking about ourselves and our identity. And we're, we also do spiritual practices that people, I don't want to say, not appropriate, but borrow from other traditions and modify to their comfort zones. Again, boundaries, but there's something about embodied experience. And we have people come in from who identify with various religious communities, come in and talk about from their personal standpoint. So it's like a smorgasbord of different glimpses, but always with the latent discussion about internal religious diversity as well as religious diversity in general. And the fact that we learn in all different ways, and how might we learn to know others, but also know ourselves better, and to be self-conscious about that. So it's by no means perfect, always a work in progress, but it's, you know, and it is battling with that old model constantly. Because in a way, I mean, and I've said this before to the class, in a way, you know, people shouldn't leave a theology or MDiv program or master's degree program here at Union and not know anything about Hinduism.
Right.
And I think it would be a disservice if they walked out the door with that. But then you also don't want to play back into the model of like, here, we're going to teach you about Hinduism, and then we're going to teach you about that. So
it's also impossible to cover everything.
Right.
There are too many religions out there.
Right. And which ones you choose. And I mean, so there's like a statistical and demographic reason for choosing things. But, you know, I always have visions of the 2.0 version of the class, which is where we, you know, go to like the Society for Ethical Culture and, you know, the Santeria practice. And, you know, we do and mix it up.
I think what I am hearing from what the course requires that I recognize in my own experience that was sort of a breakthrough for me into becoming a multiple religious belonger. I call it Catholic roots, Buddhist wings, which is something I actually borrowed, dare I say appropriated, from a text, the book The Jew and the Lotus, which is about the first delegation of a group of Jewish religious leaders and scholars to Dharamshala, where the Tibetan government in exile has its residence, and they dialogued with the Dalai Lama on contemplative practice, mysticism, scriptural tradition, monasticism, what the two have to offer to each other. And one of the Jewish converts to Buddhism who become a monastic used the phrase Jewish roots, Buddhist wings, and that struck me as an organic, poetic way to think of my own double identity. But what was the breakthrough in that, the instrumental thing, was that I was I participated in a program last summer called the Wooden Fish Project, which is was founded in, I think, 2002 or so by a Taiwanese Buddhist nun. It's a program that takes students of the West to live in an immersive novice Buddhist monastic context in monasteries, originally in Taiwan, but it's been in China for the past few years. I shaved my head, wore the robes. There were 60 of us, 30 men and 30 women, which doesn't usually happen. It's a very monastic symmetry for us to be lined up, you know, almost military style lined up, and, you know, chanted before every meal, bowed and, you know, prostrated and meditated, gave ourselves up fully to the, you know, anonymity and the surrender of that mm-hmm. way of being. Mm-hmm. And before that, that was like, I did that because I was curious about whether or not my intellectual engagement with Buddhism in the classroom of an undergraduate institution mm-hmm. that didn't have a religious affiliation was deep enough and authentic enough that it would like blossom into something that was a personal belonging.
Yeah.
And there is no way that I would have come to that if I hadn't done what I did in that immersion, in mm-hmm. that contextual, experiential way of educating.
Yeah, and that's certainly in that class in particular, there's no prescribed goal of what people will take out of it, but there is a nod to the fact that we learn in different ways, especially
mm-hmm.
interreligiously,
yeah. mm-hmm.
and that there's an intellectual level and there's a theological level. And as a theologian, I certainly do not downplay the theological discourses and engagements and think it is solely about ethics, but there's an ethical element, there's a practical element, and people learn about others and about themselves by engaging in those. And it's illuminating in terms not
yeah.
only in terms of identity,
yeah.
not just to maybe decide that one has a multiple belonging, but just to say, okay, this is where I really stand.
Right, and I'm curious also how you. I know that sometimes when we do these sort of experiential,
yeah.
education like immersive experiences,
yeah.
Sometimes they can come off as. It's like sort of appropriation, but also like I'm gonna like sit in on Juma and
yeah.
like watch the exotic Muslim students do their
yeah.
prayer and like that, and you really want to avoid that dynamic because that is obviously
yeah.
playing into again a Christocentric view. So how do you kind of prepare or make sure that all these experiences are taken sort of at like sort of face value for what they are, and it is not like a distancing of like I'm watching this in like a kind of ivory, like how do we avoid that dynamic?
Yeah, so I mean, I think one of the things like that helps with that. Well, there are a few things.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that helps with that, I mean, not to get into structure of class. One thing that helps in that is that we're doing lots of different types of learning.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not just doing reading and then we go on a site visit.
Right.
You know, we have people come in and talk from their personal standpoints. So there's like different types of
mm-hmm.
exposure. Another thing that happens helps, frankly, are the students in the class and the environment of union. And so one of the things about students in the class is that they are actually diverse. And
mm.
so I mean, now they do. That we do actually even have students that primarily identify with Judaism
mm-hmm.
or Islam or Buddhism, and that's their primary identification. So it's not no identification or multiple
mm-hmm.
belonging, but it's, you know, when you talk Christian language, I don't understand it, and I've
right.
never understood it, you know. So it's that helps because
yeah.
it produces a conversation, and it also works against the otherizing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is not... and the students... in my experience, have been open to
yeah.
participating. And the sites have been open to people participating
mm-hmm.
if they want. And I think for every single student, it is an individual negotiation.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also of if they will participate or if they will observe or how they'll participate.
Mm-hmm.
And we do leave that open. I think that's important for
yeah.
agency and for own and people's own identity. But yeah, there are times when there are nods to the exotic and, oh,
mm-hmm.
how different, or this feels uncomfortable and this feels unfamiliar. And so we talk about
right.
that. That's why, you know, I feel very strongly about the class not just being an information dump. It
mm-hmm.
should be about identity. It should be about thinking about why we are comfortable with certain things and not comfortable with
right.
other things. Why, you know, when our Jewish guest speaker comes in and starts talking about the importance of law, that, you know, many people in the room,
right.
in their Protestant Christianity start like crawling
yeah.
with like, you know, and why is that a hard concept to
right.
understand? Or why is sacred space a quiet space? Or
right.
why is sacred space a sitting space or a standing space?
Mm-hmm.
And so that kind of self-reflective element is very helpful.
Yeah.
And students call, you know, work with each other and they ask each other,
mm-hmm.
well,
yeah.
are you... not, you know, when we go to Islamic Center of NYU and you know, it's wonderful and open and Imam Latif is wonderful in hosting us all the time. And of course we're going to have the discussion about gender segregation,
right,
or biological segregation or something kind of
mm-hmm.
segregation going on in the prayer space. And we have to probe that.
Right.
And we have to probe, you know, is it an inherently bad thing or is it inherently unequal? And maybe it is. Do you have to be comfortable with it? Is everyone there comfortable with it? Why is it going on? Should it be changed? You know, so we have
right.
those conversations.
Well, that's also, yeah. that's a fantastic segue because one of the, yeah. I know one of your areas of expertise is feminist theology.
expertise.
And well, certainly more of an expertise
fascination.
Than me. and I think you've coined a term. Is that Muslima?
God, there might be many.
There might be many. So I'm fascinated. Like, if you could
yeah.
tell us a little bit about the academic work and then also some of the experiential work as a Muslim woman, like how you're
yeah.
bringing this into practice.
Yeah. So I mean, the term Muslima theology is a term that I have been using to describe my work with the possibility that it might have resonance for other
mm-hmm.
people, but not the determinative, like, this is what you're doing. To be honest, like many other feminist discourses that don't emerge from primarily white, middle-class, Western Christianity, there is a concern for the balance of similarities and,
mm-hmm.
and concerns we have in common, but also attentiveness to our particularities. And I can cut to the chase and say that there is not an attentiveness to the particularities of Muslim women
mm-hmm.
and Muslim women scholarship within feminist circles, whether they be academic or on the ground, and whether they be religious circles or non-religious circles. And that's not just the case with the scholarship of Muslim women scholars, but other communities that, especially in the U.S., and
mm-hmm.
I speak from the U.S. context, so Muslim
right.
theology comes out of my context, and that's the U.S., I should say that. I started using that term to capture a few pieces of what I was trying to do. One is the Muslima part, because my work, I do identify as a Muslim, so, and not, you know, a singular definition. I'm a very particular type
mm-hmm.
of Muslim. I have my very particular interpretations and views and stuff. But that is part of my my spiritual, personal, but also intellectual situatedness.
Mm-hmm.
And I bring certain assumptions to the process.
Right.
Okay. So I bring, and those are assumptions I can't criticize. I'm aware of what the assumptions are, but I'm also, it also says something to audience. I mean, I have an interreligious investment, so I'm very much involved in those conversations, but I also am very interested in certain liberative changes within the Muslim community that aim towards egalitarianism. So I speak within that reference.
Mm-hmm.
I always, to my students and to other people, I always describe myself as a loving critic. Like I am with it. I locate myself, among other things, within in Muslim faith, but I have some things to say.
Mm-hmm.
And have some concerns. Okay. And so it's a tensive and interesting position. So that's a nod to that. But it's also the Muslima part is that, it, you know, it means a woman. It's the feminine version. It means a woman who submits to God
mm-hmm.
Or serves God. However, I know that word submits in English
mm-hmm.
is very problematic, especially in feminist circles. Ironically enough, in Muslim women's scholarship, submission to God is the antithesis of submission to human beings,
right.
So it's the key to getting out of oppression.
Yeah.
So it's a very, well, welcome to learning about other people instead of, you know, pasting
right.
your
exactly.
assumptions on top of them. So it's a very it's a liberative standard. But I would just say that the femaleness of that is once again my individual
mm-hmm.
experiential positioning.
Right.
This is where I speak from. These are my concerns, and I won't pretend that my concerns are universal.
Mm-hmm.
But they are important. But it's also theoretical.
Right.
My work is very much involved with other feminist discourses, both within religious communities and not. And so a lot of the interpretive strategies, a lot of the methodologies, a lot of the questions that I want to raise, they come out of the conversations across disciplines with
mm-hmm.
other feminists.
Yeah.
And then just the last thing I would say, like with Muslim theology, is that I do theology.
Right.
You know, among other things. But what I do is I'm interested in crafting deconstructive critiques, yes, but also constructive theological articulations of the tradition. So in Islam, theology is sometimes you know, translated into kalam, which is kind of speculative theology about, you know, the divine attributes, like, does God have hands? And, you know, what about free will and determinism? All these great kind of philosophy of religion questions, and I love them, so don't get me wrong. But I'm talking about theology more in kind of a Christian sense. You know, constructive, theological, grappling, using the resources, the tradition, but reinterpreting and going beyond, even beyond exegesis and things. So it's not just exegesis. And so it was a way to carve out the niche of what I was doing, rooting it in feminist discourses, but also nodding to the fact that it is different. It has some connections, but it's different. So it's not, I mean, the way I deploy it is not that different from the way that womanist theologians or Moharista theologians or African women theology has been born. It's born out of a concern to push back on a universal feminist discourse while also maintaining some interconnections with that discourse.
And and for a few of our, I mean, I'm sure we have some listeners whose fluency with sort of theological terms is not going to be as high. So I'm curious if maybe you could give us an example of like an issue within Islam that you're particularly drawn to, kind of constructing a theology around and figuring out what to do with it and how to make it something that you're, you know, like I'm curious what like an example of an issue would be.
Yeah, so I mean, there's many issues. Did you want me to talk to an issue that's particularly concerning gender or women or other issues? Because my work is very interdisciplinary.
Yeah,
and
I mean, I think since we're on the topic of you know, the Muslima, I'd love to hear about sort of a woman. One that focuses on gender.
Well, sure, and I mean, so but one of the things I think I would underscore coming out at first is to say that. You know, in the first book I wrote and in my research that I've been focusing on up to now, Muslim theology is a feminist theology, but it's a feminist theology that targets the question of religious diversity.
Right.
So I just want to underscore that because that's really important. The relevance of feminist theological insights on human difference and on the way we attach value to manifestations of human difference, whether that's differences in race or differences in gender or differences in, you know, ability, the way we assign value to that, that is like the heart and core of feminist concerns. So in my research up to this point, a lot of it has been focused on saying, if we brought those ideas to bear on the way we talk about different religious traditions, might we see it differently? So I just want to say that because I do want to push back on the notion that feminist theology and those strategies and approaches are only relevant to gender and women, because I full scale do not
interesting.
They're very relevant to other discourses.
One of the podcasts we did recently was with a Christian theologian who was talking about how he has been able to articulate his own philosophies of pluralism and difference using a lot of feminist theology.
Yeah.
And so I think what you're saying resonates very much.
Because it's a total different way of looking. I mean, I always say that my main preoccupation is with human difference. I'm fascinated by it. I'm fascinated how we rank it, how we identify it, what types of difference concern us, you know, and of course gender and sexuality always concern us a lot, you know.
Yes.
But that's not the only form. And so there are some really interesting conversations between, you know, looking at the concepts that have been deployed, for instance, in race and with gender and with religious diversity. There's some interesting mashups. Okay, so that being said, so an example, I mean, there's tons of examples, but for instance, I am interested in Muslim women's leadership. So, of course, Muslim women are leaders and in various capacities. All over the world, but once again, U.S. context, Muslim women are in organizations. They are increasingly involved even in religious organizations. But I have an interest in probing Muslim women as imams. And of course, so this gets some people really ruffled up. And to some people, it's like, ho-hum, been there, done that. And they've already decided, yes, we're going to do that. And clearly, there are places in the world where there are female imams in China. I mean, they're mostly women's mosques, but they have a whole infrastructure there. But as a theologian, it's a fascinating question to me because I'm interested in the latent theological assumptions that support the idea that men should fulfill that role.
Right.
And so there's sociological reasons, there's communal reasons, there's historical reasons for why that is or how that came through. And all those are wonderfully fascinating and informing to what I'm doing. But with that issue, so I'm interested in saying, okay, so the assumption has been legalistically and ritual that only male will serve that one very particular role, which is not a formalized role in a lot of places,
right.
but is just a leading the prayer if there's male-identified and female-identified
mm-hmm.
in the prayer space. And so I don't necessarily have to say we should get rid of that or continue it, but I'm interested in what's the theology behind that. So is the theology that men are smarter? Is the theology that men are natural leaders? Is the because these are theological anthropology questions.
Mm-hmm.
Is the theology that men are somehow different from women? Are they different in certain ways? How is it that communities function this way and they want to see a male? And if it's community saying it should be a male, should it be a male? But the interesting thing there theologically is that in Islamic discourse, the qualifications for being in that role have really been knowledge-based. And capacity-based. And so that creates a bunch of intriguing questions because there are lots of women who have equal capacity, but they don't have certain genitalia, sorry to be crass, that go along that fill out the equation. And so that's an interest to me. And I also should say on that same topic, and this is from my interreligious
mm-hmm.
conversations because I'm writing a book right now on comparative feminist theology.
Mm.
So I'm crafting a Muslima theology on these issues, but in dialogue with other feminist theologies
mm-hmm.
interreligiously. And so from that, from learning about and engaging with other theologies, particularly various and diverse Christian ones, I mean, one of the questions in this realm that comes to the fore is, well, what's the experience of people who are always led by a male religious leader in that confines? Because it's not just leading prayer. It is just leading prayer, but then it's also giving the khutbahs and stuff.
Right.
And even the most, you know,
extends to pastoral care.
Yeah,
it's lots
like, yeah.
of other things.
And so, you know, and that's not a question that is really foregrounded
mm-hmm.
in Islamic discourse. Like, how does it feel,
right.
you know, to be in this? Or what kind of questions are talked about? Or what kind of subjects are chosen for sermons? And even the most inclusive and... I mean, Imam Latif is a wonderful example. Most inclusive and thoughtful
mm-hmm.
people about gender and diversity and stuff. Would it be different if it was
right.
a woman? You know, and I think from sociological and psychological studies, we already have the answer to
right.
that. Right. We already know the answer. But then, so I'm interested in the question of, does that have any relevance to theology and then the ritual we craft on the back of that
right.
theology?
Well, I know this is a dangerous thing to say to someone in the middle of writing a book, because I know the process of writing a book is very
yeah.
difficult, but once the book is done,
mm-hmm.
I can't wait to read it, but I also would love to have you back on the
yeah.
podcast to talk about it once all of these thoughts have sort of fleshed
yeah.
out.
Yeah, well, that it will be done by the end of the year. That's what I've committed to. So
well,
now I've committed publicly.
That would be amazing. I definitely
yeah.
know a lot of
yeah.
My friends who are in the rabbinate, both men and women, who think
yeah.
about similar questions in the Jewish context that would be fascinated by this topic.
Yeah, and it's a risky conversation
mm-hmm.
because it's a kind of marginal inside voice then engaging with other marginalized
right.
inside voices, and also in light of, you know, what we started discussing today, which is that, you know, teaching about or discussions on Islam and Muslims are not apolitical.
No.
So there's
right.
risks involved
mm-hmm.
in crafting Muslim theology in conversation with especially Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
But to be honest, it's not just, I think, a rich because there's other insights, but I think it's also a way to assert agency and
yeah.
and lay out the rules of the game
yeah.
rather than being told what the rules of the game
yeah.
are.
Well,
so.
I think it's really interesting. And
well,
I can't
we'll
wait.
See.
I can't wait to have another conversation
out on that.
About this.
we'll
and thank you. We are cutting right up to our
yeah,
time limit. So
absolutely.
Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Matt,
thank
thanks
you
for
all.
Making your first appearance.
Thank
we
you.
Look forward to having you back after a little break for the summer, having you on the team.
Sounds great.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Multifaithful. We'd especially like to thank our guests, Dr. Lamptey, as well as Matt, for joining us on the podcast. This was an especially fun one because we got to record it at Union Theological Seminary, which is just one of the most awesome buildings in New York to get to visit. Also where they filmed A Beautiful Mind. Fun fact for all those listeners out there. Special thank you to Luis Fados, whose music is from Of Many, and to Brian Young for editing and producing the podcast in absentia. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please be in touch at spiritual.life@nyu.edu. Please rate and review us on iTunes. We look forward to having you back for another episode next week.